Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. I'm Jordan Edwards, Communications Associate at the BJC. The 2016 Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State were held April 4th and 5th on the campus of Bethel University in St. Paul, Minnesota. The lecturer this year was Dr. Molly T. Marshall, President of Central Baptist Theological Seminary in Shawnee, Kansas. Before we get into the lectures, I have BJC Executive Director Brent Walker with me here. First, Brent, can you tell me what it was like to move the Sheridan Lectures to the Midwest? This is kind of the first time doing that, correct?
Yes, it was, and it was good. We like to diversify the presentations and the geographical location when we. So yeah, we went to Minnesota, and we were able to meet a lot of our Baptist General Conference Converge Worldwide Baptist friends. They're one of our 15 cooperating Baptist bodies in the Baptist Joint Committee's coalition. So it was good to be there.
And Brent, kind of tell me why Dr. Marshall was such a good choice for a Sheridan lecture.
Well, she's presently serving in the Midwest, as you mentioned, in Kansas City at Central Seminary. Molly and I go way back. In fact, she was one of my professors in seminary 30 years ago, and I just think so much of her. She's an accomplished scholar. She's a good communicator to students and adults alike. You know, the fact that she's a trained theologian was attractive to me in terms of selection for the Sheridan Lectures. The past lecturers have been lawyers, church historians, pastors, ethicists, but we really have not had a theologian give the lectures before. So it's important not just to diversify geographically, but the background and expertise of the lecturer is important too, and we want to keep a good mix there. So we're delighted that she was able to include us in her crowded schedule, and they turned out beautifully. I know people will enjoy the lectures if they listen to them.
Okay, great. So without further ado, let's listen to the first of two lectures. This one is titled, Understanding Religious Liberty Amidst Religious Pluralism.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you all. I've appreciated the warm hospitality, even the snowflakes, but the warm hospitality of Bethel. I'm grateful for the Baptist Joint Committee and very grateful for this partnership with Bethel and what the Sheridans have done to ensure that people at their most formative, reflective, thoughtful time in higher education are thinking about what's at stake in terms of religious liberty, separation of church and state. Over these two lectures, I'm going to use an umbrella kind of title, Competing Religious Liberties, because that's really what's at stake in our day. Brent, thank you for the kind introduction. I may go back and raise your grade after doing such. Not that they would let me back in at Southern to do so, but you have a vibrant and a welcoming school here, and it's been a joy already to worship with you in chapel this morning, to meet distinguished leaders here, and to learn something of the ethos of what you're doing here with a theological school and a very vibrant undergraduate programs, I should say, varieties of programs. Well, first, this afternoon, I want to talk about the reality of religious pluralism, both here in the United States and around the world, because it presents new challenges and new opportunities for strengthening religious liberty. And in the second lecture, I will focus more specifically on the challenge of preserving religious liberty for a Christian minority. And I will be speaking particularly of Myanmar. In the news these days, you know, emerging from a long time of a repressive military regime. And so I will be spelling out what some of the challenges, what the challenges that remain in that, as many have tried to institute a preferred religious status, which makes religious liberty for Christians much more challenging in that insular country. They are just emerging from a long history of being colonized by the British and then controlled by the military, and minority religions have quite the problem there. But first, let's focus on the reality of religious pluralism here at home. So, understanding religious liberty in the context of religious pluralism. Religious liberty is an essential part of the freedom and the dignity of humans. Our Constitution inscribes it as an inalienable right, and this founding document underscores its significance for human flourishing. Humans are religious by nature. Even those folk who aren't real quick to sign up on anybody's team, they are religious. We are created with an intense longing to worship, to understand what gives ultimate meaning to our lives, and to build communities of value. It's just how we are put together as human beings. So far from being a plague on humanity, as many believe and some experience, religions are carriers of compelling visions of human flourishing. And I'm quoting Miroslav Volf of Yale, who is writing a lot about how the world in a time of globalization needs the great religions of the world. He speaks of the non-dispensable nature of religion in this way. Religions map a way of life, foster a sense of connection with ultimate reality, and sketch a moral vision for the that gives account of the self, social relationships, and what the good is about. Now, even though there are contentious skirmishes or outright war among their competing visions, they pose questions about individual thriving and global common good like no other entity. Thus, a critical task in our day is to cultivate respect for the lived religion of others. And it's a particularly urgent issue here at home, and the shrill rhetoric of public discourse does not serve the common good. Well, you probably heard it. If not the first time, then the next 20 times it was rebroadcast. Islam hates us, during CNN's recent presidential debate. It's a pattern of reckless speech in a time of growing religious pluralism. It serves only to foment alienation for American Muslims and recruitment opportunity for radical Islamic groups. We must see this statement for what it is. It is a dangerous pandering to the most exclusivist understandings of Christianity. It stokes fear in the Jewish community also, given the close ties we have with Israel. As a Baptist, I get very nervous when the political realm speaks too much about religion. It's the role of the state to create a context where religious pluralism can flourish. It's not the role of the state to impose or favor one religion over the other. And my case study tomorrow will show when there's an attempt at imposing a state religion, you've got trouble. Rowan Williams, former Archbishop of Canterbury, has contended in Faith in the Public Square that the proper role of the state is to serve as a mediator and a broker whose job it is to balance and manage real differences. It's a pretty good definition. Nor is it the role of religion to commandeer the state for its own purposes and the cynical use of Christianity to further candidates' prospects demeans responsible faith, it seems to me. Respect for the religion of others is more than simply tolerating religious difference. Rather, it draws from the common affirmation of the dignity of humans and the right to religious liberty. It's a critical task of our time to learn from adherents of other ways of faith. And so the last thing a politician or a minister needs to do is denigrate another religion in its entirety. Every faith tradition has a radical fringe, and we ought to know better than to measure the whole by those who distort its essential teaching. And frankly, there are texts in every body of sacred literature that we wish we could expunge. There are those that I don't preach on within Holy Scripture. I practice what's called kangaroo exegesis. Just jump right over and go on. But we're in a particularly interesting time as a liberal democracy, the technical definition for us. We're going through a seismic shift in religious ethos just now. And I think the fear of religious pluralism is at the heart of the convulsive language and actions of many people. Earlier language of Christian nation, which was never appropriate given the wall of separation between church and state, is even more problematic today as varieties of religious traditions accompany those who immigrate, not to mention those already here, when our European ancestors or the European ancestors of some of us came ashore. Culture and faith are closely entwined, and damage occurs when a religion is imposed, for to some degree, it decimates culture to some extent. The question always is, how does the gospel take root in different soil? It looks different in different places. Now, I did not grow up with a generous theology of religious pluralism. I grew up in northeastern Oklahoma among conservative Southern Baptists who knew we were going to heaven, but not too sure even about those across town. We were so insular that we barely acknowledged that there were other ways of Christian faith. My form of Baptist identity, evangelical, exclusive, was the surest path to redemption. God was at work in my Baptist church. I wasn't real sure where else. I had particular questions about Roman Catholics and Jews, the only truly religious others that I knew. In those days, we still said the Lord's Prayer just after the Pledge of Allegiance. That was in junior high we were doing that. Talk about blurring church and state. I remember when I first discovered that my new Catholic friend, who had transferred from parochial school to the public junior high, did not say the concluding phrases of the Lord's Prayer. I wondered about her faith. Only later did I learn that the words, "For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever," were not really in the earliest version of the Lord's Prayer in the gospel literature, a later recension. Accompanying this narrow theology of the religious other was a missiological perspective that placed the responsibility for the salvation of all humankind on people just like me. Conversion was the goal, and if it came by conquest of another culture, so be it. Their eternal salvation was secured, even if they no longer were welcome in their families or communities or villages. Even as a child, I wondered about how to align Baptist emphasis on religious liberty with this kind of notion about the mandate to eviscerate the religious liberty, perhaps, of another. Was it appropriate simply to assume that my kind of Christian family held all the truth, and no truth was to be found elsewhere in other religious traditions. How we read Scripture seemed to demand that we view all religious traditions as idolatrous, pagan, and a path straight to hell. Was I obliged, as a faithful Christian, to condemn all, not yet his followers? Those kinds of questions kept me up at night as a young one, and perhaps they still swirl for you. Of course, I was not the first budding theologian to worry about these things. It has troubled thoughtful Christians from the time of the Apostle Paul, who strenuously argued for God's election of Israel and its continuing role in God's salvific plan. The early apologists, those second and third century Christians, sought to defend and commend the claims of Christianity, and they wanted to link the story of Jesus with the early Hellenistic philosophical traditions. They were trying to bridge the claims of Christianity. One of those early interpreters, Justin the Martyr, stands out among them as a creative thinker in his use of biblical material and the writings of secular thinkers. He said, all knowledge that people have is a product of the Logos. That sounds a little bit like some of the core values I've read about Bethel University. All wisdom, all knowledge has a grounding in this larger vision of the divine. He said, Christ, the firstborn of God, is the Word of whom all persons are partakers. Those who live in accordance with wisdom and reason are Christians, he argued. One of the reasons he's called Justin the Martyr is that not everyone agreed. In these early centuries of Christianity, there were also those who developed a doctrine of preparatio evangelica, which means a preparation of the gospel among the varied cultures who had yet to hear the message of Christ. In this view, God had already sown the older cultures with ideas and themes that would later grow to fruition through interpretation in a fully Christian context. It was a way to think about the extent, the expansive embrace of God through Christ. But these interpretations sought to frame the hopes of all the world's people through the lens of Christianity. And that's how we tend to come to this question. Is it a sufficient interpretive framework? The early apologists, earlier than Islam, also knowing little about traditions of the Far East, were struggling against a supersessionist view of Judaism. The notion now that Christianity is here, Judaism has been eclipsed. They were trying to understand the insider conversation of the New Testament, which seemed to argue for no other way of salvation, with these competing religious visions. Being a faithful student of Scripture does not necessitate an exclusivist reading, however, although there is a tension always between exclusion and welcome. You find it in both testaments as a struggle, as the Spirit nudges people to transgress boundaries. Walter Brueggemann, that beloved Old Testament scholar, goes so far as to say, the question of the other becomes the interpretive key of how to read the Bible. It's a perceptive insight, isn't it? Throughout the Bible, we see an outward spiral and the Spirit nudging those of the covenant to transgress boundaries. From the prophet Jonah's grudging proclamation to Nineveh, to Jesus' conversation with the Samaritan woman, to Philip's study with the Ethiopian eunuch, to Paul's affirmation of the ministry of Lydia, we see the scriptural narratives stress making room for the stranger, the religious and ethnic other. Now, about 50 years ago, the Roman Catholic Church decided to take this issue head on. And in Vatican II, 1962-65, they wrote a remarkable document, Nostra Aetate, which means in our time. And the church, as they were trying to update and open the windows in Rome, they began to articulate a different posture toward other ways of faith. And I think 50 years after the publication of this remarkable doctrine, we're still catching up to its implications. Several theological themes emerge. God is the creator of all. All humankind seek answers to the unsolved riddles of the human condition. There's a search for the holy among all people, and all religions deserve respect for what is true and holy in their traditions. That's from the preface to this document. The church, and I quote, regards with sincere reverence those ways of conduct and life, those precepts and teachings, which though differing in many aspects from the one which the church holds and sets forth, nonetheless often reflect a ray of that truth which enlightens all. Of special interest is the very generous statement about Muslims in this document, affirming their belief in the one God, their reverence for the faith of Abraham, and their honor of Mary. Actually, Mary shows up more in the Quran than in the New Testament, interestingly. The document also urges a more constructive relationship, and it seems so timely today, and it's just remarkable that this was written 50 years ago. Here's what it said. Since in the course of centuries, not a few quarrels and hostilities have arisen between Christians and Muslims, this sacred synod urges all to forget the past and to work sincerely for mutual understanding and to preserve as well as to promote together for the benefit of all social justice and moral welfare as well as peace and freedom. That was ratified in 1965. Now, the most extensive statement has to do with the relationship of Christians and Jews, confessing that Christians have been guilty of anti-Semitic thought and action for centuries. This opened up new opportunities, and the world has witnessed a renewal of goodwill among Christians and Jews subsequently. And then the document ends with these words. The church reproves, as foreign to the mind of Christ, any discrimination against persons or harassment of them because of their race, color, condition of life, or religion. Well, this strong statement condemns any theory or practice that leads to discrimination of any sort between persons, peoples, as far as their human dignity and rights are concerned. And it seems that we are still trying to catch up to what this meant. Catholics and Protestants alike. Protestant theologians also struggling with competing religious liberties are trying to frame ways to think about other religions. Over the past 40 years, a taxonomy has emerged: exclusivism, inclusivism, and pluralism. Simply put, let me define those. Exclusivists regard their own tradition as in sole possession of religious truth and the sole path to salvation. Exclusivism. They quote selected text, such as John 14:6 or Acts 4:12, and conclude that all other ways of faith are doomed. Inclusivists believe that the salvation which is available through their own tradition is also available within or through other religious traditions because it is the same God who is at work in them. And so that is effectively at work, even though they do not have the thematized faith toward the triune God. For example, they would affirm that the true light that enlightens everyone has come into the world through Christ, but the influence of Christ is not limited to Christianity. That seems to me to be a courageous and generous, and you will discern whether appropriate perspective. Pluralists, however, affirm that each religious tradition is independent and equally valid. Sometimes they erroneously argue that all religions have the same desired outcome and are simply different paths up the same mountain, that old metaphor. But if we have learned anything, it is that different religions pursue different ends than the Christian perspective on salvation. Now, I don't have time to develop this in these lectures, but I think it's possible to hold to a distinctively Trinitarian Christian theology and be an inclusivist. That's where I land on these things, but that's a long lecture and three more books before that's done. But let me return to the notion that God has ordained diversity and through the Spirit is working to honor faith's promise in its many forms. Religious pluralism sharpens the challenge of strongly holding one's own belief while at the same time defending the rights of others to hold other beliefs or none at all. Religious freedom is thought to be a fundamental human right. And indeed, this perspective is largely the legacy of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, issued by the UN in 1948. I would encourage you to look that up. And it basically suggests everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, religion, freedom to change religion, belief, freedom either alone or in community with others to manifest and practice belief in teaching, practice, worship, observance, etc. Tomorrow you will hear the ways in which Myanmar has so violated that particular basic affirmation of human dignity and rights. The upshot of this kind of statement, this universal declaration, is that religious belief and practice must be voluntary. That's a deeply held belief of those in the Baptist and Protestant tradition. All religions that hold that human beings have inviolable dignity because God created them and loves them will be able to embrace this argument, I believe, for religious liberty. But the complicating reality is, if you're going to be a religious exclusivist, you need to learn to be a political pluralist. And that's where it gets so difficult. A political pluralist allows there to be variety of religious liberties that don't have to compete with one another. If one is a religious exclusivist, one needs to allow that other reality too. And we have, Brent this morning talked about the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which did not allow. It wanted political exclusivism as well as religious exclusivism, and therein was the violation of freedom of conscience. Political exclusivism is the attempt of the state to impose religious belief. We see similar experiments today in Egypt, regions of Indonesia, as radicalized Islamists seek to enforce Sharia law on religious minorities. That is a political exclusivism. It's only by conviction that others have the same right of religious liberty as we, that we can create the kind of context in which humans can flourish in faithfulness to religious conviction and following the wisdom that they have received. So, in conclusion, the words you've been waiting to hear. I mean, the words of conclusion, yes. Our time calls for recognition of religious pluralism. It's a given. Max Müller, the historian of religion, suggested the person who only knows one religion knows none, really, because we understand ourselves comparatively, don't we? We sharpen our identity. This is why the young Muslim scholar Eboo Patel, who has founded the Youth Interfaith Movement, suggests that we need to grow an interfaith competency in our day. And I think he's right. A generosity of spirit as we learn from another. So how should we practice our religious liberty amidst religious pluralism? I just have four very brief suggestions. First, respect, protect the religious liberty of all. That's the work of the Baptist Joint Committee, arguing for how freedom of practice and identity should be a hallmark of what our Constitution as U.S. citizens has inscribed. Secondly, as Christians, we must learn to live out our faith with humility and with generosity. Few of us understand even the whole landscape of what Christian identity is about. You heard my earlier personal narrative of kind of the narrowness of my understanding. That was not generous, that was not hospitable, and it certainly lacked humility as I spoke with such great certitude about what I thought I knew. The third practice is to trust God to determine salvific outcomes justly. It's a text from the Hebrew Bible, "Shall not the God of all the earth do right?" Our faith compels faithful witness. We are not called to save the world, however. That's God's task, that job has been taken. Finally, to learn well another's religious pathway. It's a critical piece if we would grow in interfaith competence. Hans Küng, the famous theologian who once got a bit in trouble with the Vatican because he questioned papal infallibility. My, that kind of can get you in hot water when he questioned that. He has a wonderful statement about religious pluralism. He says there's not going to be any peace in the world until there's peace among the religions. I think he's right, because our religious convictions are the bearers, the carriers of our deepest held longings and conviction. And so to refuse to take up the sword in defense of those is really the horizon, I believe, toward which God is beckoning us in our day. Thank you.
That was Dr. Molly T. Marshall delivering the first of two 2016 Sheridan Lectures at Bethel University in St. Paul, Minnesota. Thank you for listening to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. For more podcasts, visit our podcast page at bjconline.org/podcasts or subscribe to our iTunes channel.